Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Late last year, President Obama nominated Dr. Vivek Murthy for Surgeon General. His nomination has yet to come up for a confirmation vote in the Senate. In 2012, Dr. Murthy tweeted, quote, "Guns are a healthcare issue." The NRA was quick to criticize Dr. Murthy for the tweet and declared it would, quote, "score his confirmation vote." As a result, Senate Democrats in tight reelection races have refused to support the nomination. But among medical professionals, there is growing support for treating gun violence as a public health issue. The United States averages 87 gun deaths every day, with an average of 183 injured. That's according to the University of Chicago's Crime Lab and the Centers for Disease Control. The research estimates the annual cost of gun violence to society is $100 billion. Guns are the second leading cause of death among children and teens ages 1 to 19, and the number one cause among Black children and teens, according to the Children's Defense Fund. Health professionals point out that children have survived car accidents because of their legally mandated car seats, and youth today smoke less than their parents because of publicly funded anti-smoking campaigns. Yet requiring more safety features for guns is seen as a political hot potato rather than a practical matter of protecting children and adults from injury and possible death. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about what it would look like to treat gun violence as a public health issue. What do we know about the effects of guns on public health? What will it take to introduce measures that reduce the physical and emotional impact of firearms? And do you think if we did treat gun violence as a public health issue, it would actually go down? Today, we're joined by Laura Cataletta. She is a senior staff attorney at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. It was founded right after the 101 California street shootings in San Francisco in July 1993. The center is marking its 21st anniversary this Wednesday with a dinner honoring Congresswoman Gabby Gifford and her husband, Mark Kelly. Laura tracks state firearms legislation in all 50 states, talking with citizens, legislators, and the media across the country. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. We are also joined by David Hemenway, professor of health policy and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. Professor Hemenway has written extensively on injury prevention, and his 2004 book, Private Guns, Public Health, explains the public health approach to firearms. Hi, Professor Hemenway. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, Professor Hemenway, I want to start off with you. In the U.S., there are 32,000 deaths and 74,000 injuries caused by guns every year. Because we live in a 24/7 media world and we've got access to social media, it feels like gun violence is on the rise. But according to reports, it's actually not, right? We had more gun violence in the early 90s?
Well, the peak in the United States was the early 90s, not 90s, because that was really the peak in crime in the United States.
So talk about how the numbers have changed in the last couple decades.
Yeah. Well, in the last two decades, as crime has gone down, not surprisingly, gun crime has gone down also. Gun violence has not gone down is in suicide, where suicide is now the leading cause of injury death in the United States. And guns remain about half of all suicides in the United States are gun suicides, even though maybe only about 1 or 2% of all suicide attempts are with guns. It's just guns are so incredibly lethal. And suicides are important in lots of ways in public health. And one of the things one should recognize is that a whole lot of the mass shootings were homicides followed by suicide.
Right. What about school shootings?
Certainly in the last year and a half, it looks like school shootings have gone way up. It used to be a lot of the school shootings were mostly inner-city shootings, and they weren't reported very well. But now there seems to have been a lot of copycat shootings where people are really attempting to out Columbine, Columbine, or out Sandy Hook, Sandy Hook.
Is there anything else we need to know about the data? Because do you agree that for the average person, it seems like gun violence is on the rise because we have access now to so much information so quickly?
Well, it may be that that's why people think that. People don't understand the crime has gone down so incredibly much over the last two decades. Indeed, I'm on a National Academy of Sciences panel whose sole task is to try to explain why crime and violence has gone down in the past two decades, not only in the United States, but across the developed world. And nobody really seems to understand.
So how do you answer that question? I know it's a huge question, but how do you answer that?
we're trying to figure that one out. What we do know is that still, I think what's interesting about the United States is that we've always been in the last, at least since good data have been collected, an average country in terms of crime and violence, in terms of things like robbery, in terms of things like sexual assault or burglary. But we are very, very different in terms of homicide, and it's really because we have such easy access, I think, to so many firearms and such easy access for everybody to have firearms. We make it so easily for criminals and other people to get firearms. Mm.
Laura, what really strikes you about the data when you look at it today versus the last couple decades?
I think it's really interesting to see how even though crime has gone down and firearms deaths and injuries, you know, have gone down, school shootings seem to be on the rise, and there are so many things that we can do legislatively, both at the state level and at the federal level, to attack the problem. And I think that more than ever, people are becoming aware of that. I think that after Sandy Hook, there's been so much more attention brought to the issue, and people that may have already agreed with, you know, these smart gun laws that we've been talking about for a long time, they're now making their voices heard, and they're letting legislators know what they want.
Professor Hemenway,
yeah.
What role has public health played in bringing down violence over the past couple of decades?
I don't know. Public health has been trying to do a lot of things in terms of trying to reduce inner-city violence and try to train kids in conflict resolution and how to make sure that when somebody disses you, you don't respond violently. But it's hard to know. No one really knows how effective a lot of the programs are. But there have been a large number of programs throughout the United States trying to figure out ways to reduce bullying, ways to reduce intimate partner violence, and so forth. And hopefully they've been effective. It's hard to know at a national scale if that's the reason why crime and violence are going down, especially when crime and violence are going down throughout the world.
Laura, treating gun violence as a public health issue has gotten quite a bit of attention in light of Dr. Vivek Murthy's tweet, "Guns are a health issue." He was nominated to be Surgeon General late last year. He also sent a letter to Vice President Biden saying that gun violence needs to be a priority in the country. So we'll talk more in depth about that. But what does it mean to treat gun violence as a public health issue?
Well, I think one of the things it means is to look at it from a prevention point of view. So there are, as I said, many, many different approaches to this issue. And if you look at prevention and have that foremost in your mind, you can think of different points along the process of when a gun is manufactured all the way to the point when it ends up injuring or killing somebody. You can think of all the different ways that could have been prevented. And that's very different than looking at it the other way, which is how can we punish people who have used guns? And so our organization has always focused on the prevention side, and I think it's a much more systematic way of looking at the problem.
And Professor, what would you add to that?
I think what people seem to understand is other successes in public health, the public health approach. So one of the areas we like to talk about a lot is in motor vehicles, where 60 years ago, everyone said that over 90% of motor vehicle crashes were due to driver error, most of the deaths in motor vehicles were caused by drivers deliberately disobeying the law, drinking and driving, speeding, and so forth. And so if you think of it that way, the focus was on let's do something about the driver. Let's wait till something, you know, just before something bad happens, and let's do something about making the driver more educated and punishing like crazy when they do something wrong. And it really wasn't until public health physicians began saying, let's think about prevention. Let's think about why people are getting injured. And they were realizing that people were getting injured when they crashed into the steering wheel, which didn't collapse when during a collision, that their faces were lacerated by glass in the windshield, which wasn't safety glass. They were thrown from the car because there were no seatbelts and no airbags. They would leave the car for 1 second. The car would leave the road for 1 second and hit things which were built right along the sides of the roads, lampposts and trees. And we recognized we weren't building lampposts along the sides of runways. Then public health physicians said, can't we do more than just focus on the driver? Let's go further upstream and try to figure out ways to make the car safer. Let's figure out ways to make the road safer and the emergency medical system safer. And so fast forward, 50, 60 years, and nobody thinks the drivers today are better than they were in the 1950s. We're better about drinking and driving. We're worse about distracted driving, texting, and so forth. But fatalities per mile driven in the United States have fallen over 85%. So if you were a young person in the 1950s, if 20 people there died, only about three today would die because the system is better. And that's what public health, I think, is about, is let's create a system where it's hard to make mistakes. So you're driving along in Los Angeles and you're sort of going to sleep and your car starts to weave and you're going to hit another car and horrible things are going to happen and we can blame you, blame, or we can solve the problem with suddenly you hear bop, 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 and you hit these bots dots which say, wake up, stupid, get back in the lane, and you wake up and you get back in the lane and nobody's hurt. That's the kind of thing you want. You want to make it so it's hard to make mistakes and it's hard to behave inappropriately, so it's hard to get illegal weapons, so that when you do something wrong, nobody is seriously killed or nobody's seriously injured. So in the motor vehicle area, it would be you want to reduce pedestrian fatalities. You can put police all over, or you can change the configuration of the roads so that people automatically slow down without any enforcement at all. You can put in speed bumps, and there are 24 different ways of what's called traffic calming with chicanes and neck downs. And so I think the key thing is to recognize not only that blaming is often inimical to prevention and public health, but that there's so many things one can do ahead of time to go as far upstream as possible. You don't have to wait till something bad is about to happen or has happened and then start blaming. That you can actually prevent the problem by going upstream.
That is David Hemenway, professor of health policy and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. He's written extensively on injury prevention, and his 2004 book, Private Guns, Public Health, explains the public health approach to firearms. We're also joined by Laura Cataletta. She's a senior staff attorney at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, which was founded right after the 101 California street shootings in San Francisco in July 93. The center is marking its 21st anniversary on Wednesday with a dinner honoring Congresswoman Gabby Gifford and her husband, Mark Kelly. And today we are talking about gun violence and calls from the health professional community to treat gun violence as a public health issue. The United States averages 87 gun deaths every day as a function of gun violence. An average of 183 people are injured. This is according to the University of Chicago's Crime Lab and the Centers for Disease Control. The lab research estimates the annual cost of gun violence to society is $100 billion. So what are your thoughts on treating gun violence as a public health issue? What would that look like? Do you think it would reduce gun violence if you work in the public health center or if you work with a group that advocates for gun safety? We'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What do you think would be appropriate in this case? A lot of doctors say, just like they ask patients, do you smoke? Do you drink? They want to ask patients, do you own a gun? What are your thoughts on that? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Laura, Professor Hemenway gave us a lot of examples that I think very few people would disagree with today, right, about seatbelts, about trying to get people to drive slower. And they're really good visuals and great explanations. But how do you translate that to gun violence?
Well, I think one of the most gaping holes that we have in our laws today is the fact that you can buy a gun in our country in most states without a background check if you're purchasing the gun from an unlicensed seller. And that results in 40% of gun purchases being conducted without a background check. So that means felons and domestic abusers and fugitives and all kinds of people that are prohibited from possession of a firearm are able to buy a gun, no questions asked. So that's one example. I mean, that's kind of like seatbelts. That is so obvious and so simple. And I think it's the kind of thing that once we close that loophole, it'll seem so obvious. You know, years from now, we'll say, I can't believe that we ever had that loophole. And in fact, 90% of the public supports this. So it's probably, you know, the next thing that we will see. Well, we are seeing it actually already happening. Last year, 5 states actually strengthened their laws around this issue, and it's definitely something that we've been talking about at the national level as well. But that's just one example. It's probably the most necessary and the most urgent need that we have right now. But there are many other things that we can do legislatively, much like what Dr. Hemenway was discussing with automobiles.
Professor Hemenway, what would you say is the most necessary and urgent need?
That's certainly, I would say, put as number one right now. But I think the key thing about the public health approach is to say, as we're going to have lots of cars in the United States, we're going to have lots of guns in the United States. And so what we have to do is learn, as we're slowly learning to live with cars, we have to do a better job of learning to live with guns. And what we want to do in public health is to get everybody involved, everybody on board to say, what can we do to try to make a difference? And I think sometimes you have to force them through laws. Sometimes you just want to change social norms. Sometimes you want them to volunteer. And you can think of, you know, if you step back and think, if you wanted to have a safer United States in terms of still lots of guns, what could manufacturers do? And manufacturers could do so many more things than they're currently doing. Things to reduce crime, making it hard to obliterate serial numbers as opposed to easy, making sure it's easy to trace the bullet to the gun rather than not so easy. They could do a lot of things to reduce accidents, including magazine safeties. We know that every day a kid would take out his find his dad's semi-automatic pistol and take out the magazine and think it's unloaded and shoot somebody unintentionally. We know that manufacturers could do a lot more in having personalized guns. In my car years ago, I got my car radio stolen. And the next time I bought a car, there was a little sign in the window that said, you can steal this radio, but it's not going to work once it leaves this car. We can have distributors do a whole lot more. One of the things we know about guns is that virtually every gun, 99.9% of guns in the United States were originally owned by someone who could pass a Brady background check. And somehow lots of them get into the wrong hands. One way they do this, of course, is via these sales without a background check. But even if we had complete background checks, you'd also want dealers to do a really good job to try to make sure there aren't straw purchasing. Same way we want dealers in alcohol to try to make sure that they're not selling to 17-year-olds. We want dealers in guns to do the very best job possible, not an average job, or in making sure that guns don't get into hands which clearly no one wants them to get into.
Well, we have a number of callers on this issue, so let's hear from Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you, Rose. I have a suggestion. I don't know how pliable it is. But I believe perhaps we can stem this tide of gun ownership in this country by using the same methods we use to stem the tide of smoking. Make a cultural change. Work on getting the movie industry and TV industry to stop producing so many violent shows with the use of guns. Just get the public thinking how this is not a healthy thing. It's not even a defensive thing. It's a thing that causes so much suffering and tragedy in this country. We have to move to a certain, more a European model than what we have in this country. We are no longer the Wild West. We no longer have to do the things we did in the beginnings of this nation. It's time to change. And you can do that by using the same methods we use to stem the tide of smoking in this country.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Roger. I'll get a few more calls, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Jacob in Aptos. Hi, Jacob.
Hi there. Hi. Yeah, I had a question about trigger lock mechanisms. So specifically, there was a shooting, apparently accidental shooting of a 15-year-old boy in Santa Cruz recently by a 16-year-old, and I read somewhere that there's something like 785 accidental deaths of children under 18 in a 10-year period. Mm. And it seems to me this shooting in Santa Cruz, it was a stolen gun out of a car. It seems to me there ought to be a way of requiring, possibly by ordinance, I don't know, trigger locks on guns, particularly where there's kids at home. And finally, my last question to David and Laura is, do they know anything about the fingerprint technology that might help in making guns safer?
Okay, thank you for that. Laura, do you know anything about the fingerprint technology?
Yeah, so there's currently one state that does, and it's New Jersey, that requires that once technology is available that would allow firearms to be equipped with personalization technology, so that means technology that would allow only an authorized user to fire the gun. Once that is considered available and marketable, ready to be marketed, then gun manufacturers start manufacturing those type of guns, and those are the only types of guns that can be sold in New Jersey. So a lot of progress has been recently made in this technology, and there's actually been some action to try to get New Jersey to the Attorney General to certify that, now the technology is ready and it's time to start requiring that these types of guns be sold.
And how would it work?
Well, there's actually a lot of different technology out there. So I think the technology that is the closest to being ready is a little different. It's not fingerprint. I think it requires a bracelet that activates the gun. So you have to be wearing the bracelet and holding the gun. But there's different ways that there's different types of technology. There's also a grip sensor. So there's another approach that would recognize the person's grip. There's also, the idea where you could put in a code, a digital code. So there's a lot of different ways. But the basic idea is that this would keep children and, people who steal a gun from being able to use it. And it's just like David was saying with the radio. Someone steals the radio, but then it doesn't do them any good because it won't work. Hmm. It's the same concept.
And Professor Hemenway, what are your thoughts on trigger locks?
Can I go back to the first question?
Sure, yeah.
about the cultural change?
Sure.
'Cause I think that's real important. And one of the things in public health, the public health approach, is that, yes, it's often very important to change laws, but it's also very important, whether you change laws or not, to change social norms. And I think there's so many examples in public health where we've had such successes, why public health people are so optimistic about so many things. So, for example, one of the big social changes that occurred in my lifetime was dog poop in cities. Where it used to be, you'd step on this stuff all the time, and now, partly because of law change, but also really because of a cultural change, it's really looked down upon and frowned upon to let your dog, defecate on a city sidewalk. And it makes such an incredible difference. One of the big changes that occurred in the United States 150 years ago was about dueling. It used to be if you were a white upper class male and you were disrespected, dissed, by another white upper-class male, that you felt you had to fight a duel. Hmm. And somebody would get killed. And there's so many Americans in U.S. history, famous Americans, who died from Alexander Hamilton on down in these crazy duels. And somehow it was always illegal, and yet somehow we changed social norms.
So hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, but I'd love to continue talking about culture, and then we will also talk about trigger locks. Today we are talking about calls to treat gun violence as a public health issue. We'll be back after this.
Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco, this is your call. To join in today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We love to hear new voices on the program. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you can send your email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or simply leave a comment there if you'd rather be anonymous at yourcallradio.org. www.bbc.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. And then at noon today, Backstory here on KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about how we should deal with the shortage of primary care physicians. Only 30% of all doctors practice primary care, and based on population growth, the Annals of Family Medicine predict that we're going to need about 52,000 primary care docs by 2025. So what explains this shortage, and what are some of the solutions? Tomorrow night, I'll be in conversation with Dave Zirin, who will be back from the World Cup in Brazil. It's taking place at the Center for Political Education, 522 Valencia, starting at 7 o'clock. And then Dave will be on our show on Wednesday, so be sure to tune in for that. And then coming up on Thursday, we will talk about whistleblower protections. And if you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about calls to treat gun violence as a public health issue. The U.S. averages 87 gun deaths every day. 183 people are injured, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Guns are the second leading cause of death among kids and teens ages 1 to 19, the number one cause among Black children and teens, according to the Children's Defense Fund. So a lot of health professionals are saying it's time we treat this as a public health issue. Last year, President Obama nominated Dr. Vivek Murthy for Surgeon General. He believes that guns should be treated as a public health issue. As a result, the NRA was quick to criticize him. They declared that it would, quote, score confirmation votes from politicians. Some Senate Democrats, conservative Democrats in tight reelection races, are now refusing to support the nomination. So what are your thoughts on this? Do you think guns should be treated as a public health issue? What do you think that should look like if you work in public health? We'd love to hear from you. If you're a gun owner, what are your thoughts on this? Do you think that that would bring gun violence down? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Laura Cataletta, a senior staff attorney at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. They were founded right after the 101 California street shootings in San Francisco in July 1993. They're marking their 21st anniversary this Wednesday. And we're joined by David Hemenway, professor of health policy and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. He wrote a book, Private Guns, Public Health, in 2004 to discuss the public health approach to firearms. Professor Hemenway, before the break, we were talking about culture. And I'm wondering, you know, since you wrote your book 10 years ago, what are your thoughts on how the culture around guns has really changed? I keep thinking about how we now are seeing gun owners bring in their shotguns and other types of guns to restaurants and Target, for example. I mean, we already have Chili's, Chipotle, and Sonic have banned people from bringing in rifles. The NRA was quick to condemn these people, saying that it was, quote, downright weird. And then they completely changed their tune and called the criticism a mistake. So what are your thoughts about how the culture has changed?
So two things. One is about 10 years ago, we did a national survey and asked people, do you think regular citizens should be allowed to bring their guns into restaurants and movie theaters and government buildings and so forth? And it was the one thing which everybody agreed, over like 90 to 95% of the people said, no, 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 please don't. This is not a good thing to do. The culture so far hasn't changed a great deal. It's very sad. Most other countries, when there's mass shootings like Columbine or Sandy Hook, they've changed not only the laws but the culture. And so far in the United States, we haven't. But all the good, you know, things in public health that have happened through the years have taken a long, long time. Even the change in smoking in the United States, it took a long, long time. And so I'm very optimistic. But and there's still so so many social norms, I think, that most people would like to see changed that could make a great difference.
Laura, what would you add to that? I mean, the NRA and others target President Obama, but the Brady Group has given him failing grades. He's actually expanded gun rights. A couple years ago, he passed a measure that allows people to carry concealed guns in national parks.
I think that President Obama is facing a huge obstacle with Congress. It's very hard right now to get anything done in Congress. He's been able to do limited things through executive action, but to get the cooperation of Congress right now, given the makeup of Congress, is difficult. So I think that, you know, we're hopeful that with new people, you know, taking over in November, it'll be better. But I do think that there's an interesting dynamic when it comes to guns, which is that even though, you know, the culture does have, you know, in movies and entertainment, there's all this glorification of guns. I think the average person, be they Republican or Democrat, they don't want to see guns in public. They don't want guns at Chili's or Chipotle or Starbucks. They are very uncomfortable with that idea, and they also overwhelmingly support curbing gun sales and requiring background checks and waiting periods and locking devices and all of these different ideas. So I think there's a disconnect between kind of what you see in movies, which is fantasy, and what is the truth in reality and what people want in their everyday lives.
All right. Well, thank you for the phone calls. We have full lines, so we'll go through a few and then we'll get comments. Let's hear from Dr. Dixter in Berkeley. Hi, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. The genie is out of the box. You're not going to put these tools back in. That is realistic. The problem is education. We talk about education for many, many different aspects of our culture. It's about training. Guns are tools. You don't put dangerous tools in the hands of the untrained. I grew up in an urban area, New York City. I went to an urban high school in New York City. There was a gun club. People didn't run around. Now, of course, there are guns in the city. We all know that. But we're talking about the micro right now. And I think that needs to be addressed. I am not a member, by the way, of the NRA. But one more point, and I will throw it to the panel. Originally, the NRA was about education. And it got into the hands of the crazies. Maybe we need another group, an offshoot, to get back to the original heart of what that group was all about. And remember, I am not a NRA member, and I don't have a gun in my house, but I work with tools, very dangerous tools. So please, please respond to me.
All right, Dr. Dixter, thank you. We'll get a response in just a couple minutes. We're going to go through a few more calls because we have so many on the line. Let's go to Megan in San Francisco. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm really interested in the call today because I work in an organization called the Center for Youth Wellness, which is studying how traumatic events in childhood impact children's long-term health. And I just wanted to bring up, I really appreciated the facts that you presented at the beginning around the immediate impact of gun violence. But I wanted to bring up as well the impact of community violence on children's long-term health, particularly around the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. I don't know if you're familiar with it. But basically that if children have four or more adverse childhood experiences when they're young, they're 2.2 more times as likely to have heart disease, 2.4 times likely to have a stroke, 1.9 times likely to have cancer, and 1.6 times likely to have diabetes. And this is an emerging field, but I just wanted to bring up that community violence is impacting not only those who are directly affected by the shootings themselves, but the young people who are a part of the community and the culture. Just wanted to bring that up as well.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm glad you brought that up, and we'll definitely address that in just a few minutes. Thanks for calling, Megan. Let's go next to Marie Louise in Palo Alto.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
Thank you. The thing I'd like to bring up again is that some years ago we spoke of telling store owners that were selling toys that we didn't want to have guns or violence kind of promoting toys there. And I was once in a store where a child was in another lane, and I hear a voice from a toy, and it says only, "Kill, kill, kill." And, you know, I could not believe it, but then I went around the corner, and this toy was more than a foot high, and a fellow in, what do we call it, clothes that are for camouflage. And so the figure is holding a gun, and also voices, "Kill, kill, kill." And I am thinking that perhaps now we can again think about at least asking store owners to not have these kinds of toys. So that's mine.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Professor Hemenway, that goes back to the culture question, but how would you address that in terms of marketers reaching out to children?
I agree with the caller. What we really want to live in a culture where people actually think about children. When I was young and television was just being started, you heard people actually say, you know, we have an incredible responsibility. We're going into people's homes where there are children, and we really have to watch what we're doing. And we've sort of lost that, which is too bad. Something I would like to say, though, is that most other countries, their kids play violent video games. Their kids also, you know, have violent toys. But none of the other first world countries have the gun problem we have. And that's because they don't have all these handguns lying around and such weak, weak gun laws.
So is that it? I mean, when you look at the numbers here in the U.S. compared to other countries, they don't even compare. And so is that the reason?
Yeah, that's the reason. Compared to the developed, there are countries which have very unstable governments or are in civil war, which do worse than we do. But all the other first world democracies do so much better. I teach at a school of public health where there's all these international students who love the United States, but they just can't understand why we allow our gun problem to happen.
Hmm.
And Rose, can I jump in real
please.
Quick? We actually did a study where we ranked all of the state's gun laws in our country, and we listed them in order from the best, strongest gun laws to the weakest. And then we looked at those numbers and we compared them to the gun death rates in all of the states. And although this wasn't a causative study, we saw a very strong correlation between states that had strong gun laws and low gun death rates. And the reverse was also true. The states with the weakest gun laws had the highest gun death rates.
What would you say is the most effective gun law, or maybe a couple?
Well, you know, I think there are so many, like we have been talking about, there are so many different types of gun laws and approaches to attacking this problem. I don't know that there are enough studies out there to really know what's the most effective, but we do know, you know, that background checks are able to stop huge numbers of prohibited people. We know that keeping guns locked in the home and unloaded definitely saves children's lives. We know waiting periods are effective. We know that these laws work. And I don't know if Dr. Hemenway knows which one is the most effective, but I think there aren't enough studies out there is one of the problems.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there are studies out there to suggest maybe licensing of gun owners matters, but there's so many different types of laws that other countries have that we don't have. And most of our laws are filled with loopholes, and we haven't had very good data or much money to do really good studies. So it's very hard to say, oh, yes, this law really, really mattered a lot.
Hmm. Professor, since you do a lot of work and you know about what's going on overseas, what laws do you see overseas that you think should be passed here?
Well, I would argue for gun licensing. I would argue for, as one of the callers talked about, gun training. We have a situation in the United States where you can buy a gun without any training at all in many states.
Hmm.
You don't even have to know how to use it. You don't have to have ever fired it. You don't have to understand the ramifications of having such a dangerous product in your house. And that would be. But there are so many you know, I'd hate to just say, here's the one or two.
Right. But do you think people know about this? Because I went to a gun show in Oklahoma City about, I don't know, it was in 2005. And I was told that I could get a semi-automatic living in California in just 3 days with a really quick background check. I just had no idea it was that easy to buy a semi.
And California has some of the strongest laws in the United States.
Right, but they said they could send it to me from Oklahoma to California.
So in California, like Dr. Habenoy said, we do have the strongest gun laws in the country, and even here there are loopholes, and it's you know, it's not as hard as it probably should be to get a gun.
Megan wanted to talk about addressing the secondhand effects on kids in areas with a lot of violence. And the group Cure Violence says that we really need to look at the child's past in order to figure out how to treat them. And maybe you both can talk about this. Professor Hemenway, I mean, you've got different kinds of gun violence, right? And so how would you tailor addressing this through a public health lens when you're talking about domestic abuse, urban abuse, mass shootings, suicide? I mean, it adds another layer of complexity to this issue, right?
Yes, I think the main point that I would emphasize is that it's in gun violence, it's not just the victim who's really hurt. It's also the shooter may be traumatized, and then the witnesses are traumatized, and then the whole community can be traumatized. Exposure to violence, this notion of trauma, you know, which is at its severe form as PTSD, can really ravage an entire community. And we have to recognize that this is due to, you know, gun violence, and it's not just sort of them or something like that. It's that every gun in the United States was once owned by someone who passed the Brady background check. And how did they get into the hands of people who everyone agrees should not have a gun? And somehow they did, and they did very, very easily. And this does not happen so much in other countries, other developed countries, but it happens here, and it has to do with our laws.
Laura, what would you add to that?
Well, I think the other challenge is that sometimes guns get into the hands of people that shouldn't have them, but that person hasn't been come to the attention yet of the authorities. So they might not be a felon. They might not yet have a, you know, misdemeanor or domestic violence, the things that would prohibit them from possessing a gun. So they possess a gun, and they're a very dangerous person, but, you know, that no one knows that yet. So that's one of the reasons that there's a bill right now that's been introduced that would allow for a gun violence restraining order. And that's Nancy Skinner's bill in California, and that would allow a family member or a neighbor or somebody who knows the person to petition to have that gun removed from the person for up to a year.
And what about the plans to allow doctors to ask patients about whether they own guns? Dr. Vivek Murthy, the nominee for Surgeon General, wrote a letter to Vice President Biden last year and said, one of our most important tasks as healthcare providers is to counsel our patients about how to take care of themselves, prevent disease and injury. We counsel them about tobacco, educate them about diet, remind them to wear seatbelts. Yet gun violence is an area where both state and federal policies have prohibited us from doing our job. Research shows that having a gun at home increases risk of injury and suicide. Despite this, legislators in multiple states have sought to prevent doctors from assessing that risk by limiting what doctors can talk about with their patients. Professor Hemenway, this is an interesting one. What do you think about it?
Oh, I think this is crucial. We have more suicides than homicides in the United States, and many, many more gun suicides than gun homicides. Suicides is the leading cause of injury death in the United States, now surpassing motor vehicles. What we do know about guns more than anything else, the evidence is so overwhelming that a gun in the home really increases the likelihood that someone in the home will die of a suicide. And it's really important for everyone to know, and whether we have laws or not laws, is for everyone to know that if somebody is going through a rough patch, you know, the guy's just gotten divorced, he's talking crazy, he's drinking, that person should not have easy access to a gun. Mm-hmm. And we should change social norms to make it very clear that society thinks, oh, you know, we're not requiring you to get rid of your gun, but you should know it's time to temporarily store your gun someplace else. Just as friends don't let friends drive drunk, your friends should say, hey, you know, things are going bad. Maybe in 3 months from now you'll get a new girlfriend, things will be fine. But let us store your guns for a while. And that can make an enormous change. Just one more thing.
Yeah.
There's huge differences in rates of suicide death across states, across cities, across regions. And they are not explained by differences in depression, differences in mental health, differences in suicide ideation, or even really differences in suicide attempts. What they are largely explained by is easy access to guns, where there are more guns in households, where there are easy access to guns through weak gun laws. That's where there's the most suicides.
We've done shows on this, on suicide, and the doctors have said that also it's important to point out that if people take pills, for example, or even in some cases, you know, jump off the Golden Gate Bridge and survive, they often say that they regret their decision and they're happy to be alive. But when they shoot themselves, it's very rare that they survive.
That's right. The case fatality rate is something like 90%. And people have been followed who, over time, who have attempted suicide in a lethal way that everyone thought they would die, and they thought they would die and they didn't. And then you find out how many of these people subsequently go on to commit suicide, and it's typically less than 10%.
Wow.
So if they can survive that, they're going to probably lead, you know, reasonable lives.
Laura, did you want to jump in?
Well, I just wanted to add that this is a perfect example of one of the ways that the NRA has become so extreme. Mm-hmm. There is a law in Florida that actually prohibits medical providers from asking about guns in the home and how they're stored. And a medical provider can be disciplined if they ask about this. And it's so absurd and it's so extreme, and I think people really need to know about that, because I think most people would be appalled to know that there's a law such as that. And there's also other states that, as soon as that law was passed, other states started introducing the same legislation. Fortunately, it hasn't been enacted anywhere else. But it's so out of touch with the public and even gun owners, and I think that, you know, attention needs to be drawn to that.
I mean, from a doctor's point of view, it would almost be malpractice if someone comes in with their adolescent child and they're saying, look, the kid's talking crazy, he's trying to commit suicide. The doctor should be talking to them, talking about a suicide plan. And one of the things they have to be talking about, if they're a good physician, is make sure you get lethal weapons out of the home for a while. You can't have a loaded gun lying around where you have a child who is going through a bad period.
We have a related question from Stevan, who says, what about antidepressants? Most mass shootings have involved these drugs and side effects of suicidal feelings. Professor?
It's interesting about the mass shootings, and I don't think most of the mass shootings were by people who are suicidal. That's no question. But most people who are suicidal have no, you know, don't commit mass shootings. And in other countries, this doesn't happen so very much because there's no easy access to lethal weapons for anybody.
We've got time for one more caller. Let's hear from Karen in Oakland. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me on. On the subject of changing the culture relating to guns, I wanted to report on something that happened at our meeting of our North Oakland Neighborhood Crime Prevention Council a couple of weeks ago. We had a presentation on a new program from the American Academy of Pediatrics called Asking Safe Saves Kids. And it encourages parents to ask in a non-confrontational way whether the house their child is going to go and play at has an unlocked gun in the house. And if the answer turns out to be yes, simply to suggest politely that it might be better if the kids played at the house that doesn't have an unlocked gun.
Hmm.
And that's an attempt to change the culture. I don't know how well it's going to work. It's just started, but this presentation was backed by the Oakland Police Department.
We did an evaluation of such an attempt in Rockland, Illinois, which had some success. And what was most interesting is that very, very, very few, in insy beansy percent of gun owners were at all had any problems at all with this.
Final thoughts from both of you. I mean, how are you going to get this to be taken seriously by policymakers? I mean, Professor, is that what it's going to take to treat gun violence as a public health issue? at the end of the day? Or?
Yeah, I mean, what we're trying to do, I mean, the thing is everyone has to play a part, and you have to do what you're good at. What we're trying to do is create good data systems like the National Violent Death Reporting System and get them funded, and to get good gun questions on CDC surveys like the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System, and we're trying to do good studies and hopefully find brave foundations who will give money for good studies.
And Laura, what would you add to that? I mean, how are you planning to go about doing this with such opposition from groups like the NRA and then, you know, the profitable weapons industry?
Well, I think that we are stronger than we've ever been before because, as I said before, we have so many new groups working on this issue. And so our role is working on legislation, especially at the state level, and we will continue to push smart gun laws. And just like David said, you know, you need courageous funders, you need courageous legislators. And they do exist, they are out there, and they just need to know they have the support of the people behind them.
After the Newtown massacre, over 1,500 bills were introduced across the country to address this issue. And so what do you think people can do about this? People who want to get involved in this, Laura, what's most effective?
I think that they need to make sure their elected official knows that they are paying attention and needs to know what their opinion is. So I think one thing that the NRA has been successful at is jamming the phone lines, calling, email, writing, and our side hasn't done that as much. And I think that is starting to happen more on our side, and I think it has to continue. I think just having your voice heard is the most important thing.
And Professor Hemenway, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I would say it's hard to do individually, but what's good is if people form groups, if through their churches or synagogues, they form groups and say, this is an important issue, and we're going to take on this issue for a while, and we're going to really learn about it, and we're going to be go on blogs and on the Internet, and we're going to have our voices heard and not just here, and so that when it's not just people hearing a tiny percentage of gun owners, because most gun owners, as has been stated, are for very sensible and reasonable laws.
And we just got a call from Linda who wanted us to know about a public forum about guns and mental health on July 10th at 3:30 at the San Francisco Public Library, the main library. Thank you for that, Linda. David Hemenway is professor of health policy and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center and author of Private Guns, Public Health. Laura Cataletta is a senior staff attorney at the Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. How should we deal with the shortage of primary care physicians? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about why only 30% of all doctors practice primary care. Based on population growth, the Annals of Family Medicine predict that we'll need another 52,000 primary care doctors by 2025. Part of the problem is that these doctors make about one half of what specialists make and are required to see far too many patients per day. So what are the solutions? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.